had happened to her. She had not revealed much at all about herself. Blomqvist could not guess what she had done to Bjurman, but she had not killed him. Oddly enough. Otherwise Bjurman would have been dead 2 years ago. She must have been controlling him in some way and for some purpose that he could not begin to understand. Then he realized that he had the means of her control right there on the desk, the DVD. As long as she had that, Bjurman was her helpless slave, and Bjurman had turned to the man he supposed was an ally, Zalichenko, her worst enemy, her father. Then a whole chain of events. Bjurman had been shot first, then Svensson and Johansson. But how? What could have made Svensson such a threat? And suddenly he knew what must have happened in Enschede. Blomqvist found a piece of paper on the floor beneath the window. Salander had printed out a page, crumpled it into a ball, and tossed it away. He smoothed it out. It was from Aftonbladet's online edition about the kidnapping of Miriam Wu. He did not know what role Wu had played in the drama, if any, but she had been one of Salander's very few friends. Maybe her only friend. Salander had given her old apartment to her. Now she was lying in the hospital, badly beaten. Niedermann and Zalichenko. First her mother, then Miriam Wu. Salander must be crazy with hatred. This was one provocation too many. And now she was on the hunt. At lunchtime, Armansky received a call from the rehabilitation home in Ersta. He had expected to hear from Palmgren much earlier, and had avoided making contact with him. He'd been afraid that he would have to report that Salander was guilty beyond all doubt. Now at least he could tell him that there was, in fact, reasonable doubt of her guilt.
"How far did you get?"
Palmgren said, without beating about the bush.
"With what?"
"With your investigation of Salander."
"And what makes you think I'm doing any such investigation?"
"Don't waste my time, Dragan,"
Armansky sighed.
"You're right."
"I want you to come and see me,"
Palmgren said.
"I can come this weekend."
"Not good enough. I want you to come tonight. We have a great deal to discuss."
Blomqvist had made himself coffee and a sandwich in Salander's kitchen. He half hoped to hear her keys in the door, but he was not optimistic. The empty hard drive in her power book told him that she had already left her hideout for good. He had found her apartment too late. At 2:30 in the afternoon he was still sitting at Salander's desk. He had read Björk's non-report 3 times. It had been formulated as a memo to an unnamed superior. The recommendation was simple: get a pliable psychiatrist who would admit Salander to the children's psychiatric clinic. The girl was disturbed, as was clearly demonstrated by her behaviour. Blomqvist was going to devote very particular attention to Björk and Teleborian in the coming days. He was looking forward to it. His mobile rang and interrupted his train of thought.
"Hi again. It's Marlin. I think I've got something."
"What?"
"There's no Ronald Niedermann in the social security records in Sweden. He's not in any telephone book or tax records or on the vehicle licensing database or anywhere else. But listen to this. In 1998, a corporation was registered with a patent office. It's called KAB Import AB and has a P.O. box address in Göteborg. The company imports electronics. The chairman of the board is Carl Axel Bodin, hence KAB, born in 1941.
It doesn't ring a bell.
"Not for me either. There's also an accountant on the board who's registered at a couple of dozen other companies. He seems to be one of those nominal finance directors that small companies need. The company has been more or less dormant since it was set up, but then the third member of the board is an R. Niedermann. He doesn't have a social security number in Sweden. He was born on January 18th, 1970, and is listed as the company's representative in the German market."
"Good work, Marlin." "Very good. Do we have an address apart from the P.O. box?"
"No, but I've tracked down Carl Axel Bodin. He's registered in West Sweden and lives at the address for P.O. box 612 in Gossenberga. I looked it up. It seems to be a property in the country not far from Nossebro, northeast of Göteborg."
What do we know about him?
He declared an income of 260,000 kroner 2 years ago. According to our friend on the police force, he has no criminal record. He has a license for a Moose rifle and a shotgun. He has two cars, a Ford and a Saab, both older models. No points on his license. He's unmarried and calls himself a farmer.
A man about whom we know nothing, who has no police record.
Blomqvist thought for a few moments. He had to make a decision.
One more thing. Dragan Armansky called several times looking for you.
Thanks, Marlene. I'll call you later.
Mikhail, is everything okay with you?
No, everything isn't okay, but I'll be in touch.
As a good citizen, he ought to call Bublansky. If he did, he would either have to tell him the truth about Salander, or end up in a muddled situation of half-truths and withheld facts. But that was not the real problem. Salander was out looking for Niedermann and Zalachenko. He had no idea how far she had gotten, but if he and Eriksson could find an address for P.O. Box 612 in Gossaberga, there was no doubt that Salander could, too. It was very likely that she was heading to Gossaberga. That was the natural next step. If he called the police and told them where Niedermann was hiding, he'd have to tell them that Salander was probably on her way there. She was being sought for three murders and the shooting in Stallarholmen, which would mean that the National Armed Response Team, or some equivalent, would be tasked with taking her in. And Salander would no doubt put up a violent resistance. Blomqvist got a pen and paper and made a list of things he could not, or would not, want to tell the police. First, the address in Mosebacke. Salander had gone to a great deal of trouble to ensure the privacy of her apartment. This was where she had her life and her secrets. He was not going to give her away. Then he wrote Bjurman and added a question mark after the name. He glanced at the DVD on the desk. Bjurman had raped Salander. He had merely killed her. He had outrageously abused his position as her guardian. He should be exposed for the swine he was. But there was an ethical dilemma here. Salander had not told the police. Did she want to be exposed in the media by a police investigation in which the most harrowing, intimate details would be leaked in a matter of hours? The DVD was proof, and stills from it would probably end up in the evening papers. It was up to Salander to decide how she wanted to proceed. But if he had been able to track down her apartment, sooner or later the police would do so too. He put the DVD in his bag. Then he wrote Bjork's report. In 1991 it had been stamped top secret. It shed light on everything that had happened. It named Zalachenko and made clear Bjork's role, and together with a list of Johns from Svensson's computer, it would give Bjork some anxious hours facing Bublansky, and in light of the correspondence, Teleborian would find himself in deep shit too. The documents would lead the police to Gossaberga, but at least he would have a head start. He started word and wrote in outline form the key facts he had discovered during the past 24 hours from his conversations with Bjork and Palmgren, and from the material he had found at Salander's place. It took him about an hour. He burned the document onto a CD along with his own research. He wondered whether he ought to check in with Armansky, but thought, the hell with it. He had enough balls to juggle already. Blomqvist walked into Millennium and went straight to Berger's office.
"His name is Zalachenko," he said, without even saying hello. "He's a former Soviet hitman from one of the intelligence services. He defected in 1976 and was granted asylum in Sweden and given a salary by SEPO. After the end of the Soviet Union, he became, like many others, a full-time gangster. Now he's involved in sex trafficking and smuggling weapons and drugs."
Berger put down her pen.
"Why am I not surprised that the KGB is popping up in the action?"
"It's not the KGB. It's the GRU, the Military Intelligence Service."
"So it's serious?"
Blomqvist nodded.
"You mean he's the one who murdered Dag and Mia?"
"It wasn't him, no. He sent someone. Ronald Niedermann, the monster that Marlin had been finding out about."
"Can you prove this?"
"More or less. Some of it is guesswork, but Bjurman was murdered because he asked Zalachenko for help in dealing with Lisbeth."
Blomqvist told her about the DVD Salander had left in her desk.
"Zalachenko is her father. Bjurman worked formerly for SEPO in the mid-70s, and was one of those who made Zalachenko officially welcome when he defected. Later, Bjurman became a lawyer with his own practice and a full-time crook doing jobs for an elite group within the security police. I would think there's an inner circle that meets now and then in the men's sauna to control the world and keep the secrets about Zalichenko. I'm guessing that the rest of Seppo has never even heard of the bastard. Lisbeth threatened to crack the secret wide open, so they locked her up in a children's psychiatric unit.
That can't be true.
Oh, but it is, Blomqvist said. Lisbeth wasn't especially manageable then, nor is she now. But since she was 12 years old, she's been a threat to national security. He gave her a summary of the story.
This is quite a bit to digest, Berger said. And Doug and Mia
were murdered because Doug discovered the link between Bierman and Zalichenko.
So what happens now? We have to tell the police, don't we?
Parts of it, but not all. I've copied the significant information onto this disk as backup, just in case. Lisbeth is looking for Zalichenko. I'm going to try to find her. Nothing of this must be shared with anybody.
Mikhail, I don't like this. We can't withhold information in a murder investigation.
And we're not going to. I intend to call Bublansky, but my guess is that Lisbeth is on her way to Gossenberger. She's still being sought for 3 murders, and if we call the police, they'll unleash their armed response team and backup weapons with hunting ammunition, and there's a real risk that she would resist arrest, and then anything could happen. He stopped and smiled grimly. If nothing else, we ought to keep the police out of it so that the armed response team doesn't come to a sticky end. I have to find her first. Berger looked dubious. I don't intend to reveal Lisbeth's secrets. Bublansky will have to figure those out for himself. I want you to do me a favor. This folder contains Björk's report from 1991, and some correspondence between Björk and Teleborian. I want you to make a copy and offer it to Bublansky or Murdig. I'm leaving for Göteborg in 20 minutes.
Mika?
I know. But I'm on Lisbeth's side through it all. Berger pressed her lips together and said nothing. Then she nodded.
Be careful, she said.
But he had already left.
I should go with him, she thought.
That was the only decent thing to do, but she still hadn't told him that she was going to leave Millennium, and that it was all over, no matter what happened. She took the folder and headed for the photocopier. The box was in a post office in a shopping center. Salander didn't know Göteborg, nor where in the city she was, but she found the post office and positioned herself in a café where she could keep watch on the box through a gap in a window where there was a poster advertising the Svensk Kassatjänst, the improved Swedish postal system. Irene Nesser wore more discreet makeup than Lisbeth Salander. She had some silly necklaces on and was reading Crime and Punishment, which she found in a bookshop 1 street away. She took her time, occasionally turning a page. She'd begun her surveillance at lunchtime and had no idea whether anyone came regularly to pick up the mail, whether it might be daily or every other week, whether it had already been collected earlier in the day, or whether anyone ever turned up at all. But it was her only lead, and she drank a café latte while she waited. She was about to doze off when she suddenly saw the door to the box being opened. She glanced at the clock. 1:45.
Lucky as shit.
She got up quickly and walked over to the window, where she spotted someone in a black leather jacket leaving the area where the boxes were. She caught up with him on the street outside. He was a thin young man in his 20s. He walked round the corner to a Renault and unlocked the door. Salander memorized the license plate number and ran back to her Corolla, which was parked only 100 yards away on the same street. She caught up with the car as it turned onto Linnégatan. She followed him down Avenyn and up towards Nordstan. Blomqvist arrived at Central Station in time to catch the X-2000 train at 5:10 p.m. He bought a ticket on board with his credit card, took a seat in the restaurant car, and ordered a late lunch. He felt a gnawing uneasiness in the pit of his stomach and was afraid he had set off too late. He prayed that Salander would call him, but he knew that she wouldn't. She had done her best to kill Zalichenko in 1991. Now, after all these years, he had struck back. Palmgren had delivered a prescient analysis. Salander had experienced personally that it was no use talking to the authorities. Blomqvist glanced at his laptop bag. He had brought along the Colt that he'd found in her desk. He wasn't sure why he had taken the gun, but he'd felt instinctively that he must not leave it in her apartment. He knew that wasn't much of a logical argument.
As the train rolled across Orstabron, he flipped open his mobile and called Bublansky.
"What do you want?"
Bublansky said, obviously annoyed. "To tie up loose ends," Blomqvist said.
"Loose ends of what?"
"This whole mess. Do you want to know who murdered Svensson, Johansson, and Bjurman?"
"If you have information, I'd like to hear it."
"The murderer's name is Ronald Niedermann. That's the giant who boxed with Paolo Roberto. He's a German citizen, 35 years old, and he works for a scumbag named Alexander Zalachenko, also known as Zala." Bublansky said nothing for a long time, and then Blomqvist heard him sigh, turn over a sheet of paper, and click his ballpoint.
"And you're sure about this?"
"Yes."
"Okay. So where are Niedermann and this Zalachenko?"
"I don't know yet, but as soon as I work it out, I'll let you know. In a little while, Erika Berger will deliver to you a police report from 1991. In it, you'll find all sorts of information about Zalachenko and Salander."
"Like what?"
"That Zalachenko is Lisbeth's father, for example. That he's a hitman who defected from the Soviet Union during the Cold War."
"A Russian hitman?"
Bublansky echoed. "A faction within SEPO has been supporting him and concealing his criminal dealings." Blomqvist heard Bublansky pull up a chair and sit down.
"I think it would be best if you came in and made a formal statement."
"I don't have time for that, I'm sorry."
"Excuse me?"
"I'm not in Stockholm at the moment, but I'll send word as soon as I find Zalachenko."
"Blomqvist, you don't have to prove anything. I have doubts about Salander's guilt, too."
"But I'm just a simple private investigator who doesn't know the first thing about police work." It was childish, he knew, but he disconnected without waiting for Bublansky's reply. Instead, he called Annika Giannini. "Hi, sis."
"Hi. Anything new?"
"I might be needing a good lawyer tomorrow."
"What have you done?"
"Nothing too serious yet, but I might be arrested for obstructing a police investigation. But that's not why I called. You couldn't represent me anyway."
"Why not?"
"Because I want you to take on the defense of Lisbeth Salander, and you can't look after both of us."
Blomqvist gave her a rapid rundown of the story.
Giannini was ominously silent. Finally, she said,
"And you have documentation of all this?"
"I do."
"I'd have to think it over. Lisbeth really needs a criminal lawyer."
"You'd be perfect."
"Mika."
"Listen. You were the one who was furious with me because I didn't ask for help when I needed it."
When they'd finished their conversation, Blomqvist sat thinking. Then he picked up his mobile and called Holger Palmgren. He didn't have any particular reason for doing so, but he wanted to tell him that he was following up one or two leads, and that he hoped the whole story would be resolved within the next few hours. The problem was that Salander had leads, too. Salander reached for an apple in her backpack without taking her eyes off the farm. She lay stretched out at the edge of the woods with a floor mat from the Corolla as a ground sheet. She had taken off her wig and changed into green tracksuit pants with pockets, a thick sweater, and a mid-length windbreaker with a thermal lining. Gosseberger Farm lay about 400 yards from the road. There were four buildings. The main building was about 120 yards in front of her. An ordinary white frame house on two floors with a shed and a barn 70 yards beyond the farmhouse. Through the barn door she could see the front of a white car. She thought it was a Volvo, but it was too far away for her to be sure. Between her and the main building there was a muddy field that extended to the right about 200 yards down towards a pond. The driveway cut through the field and disappeared into a small stand of trees towards the road. Next to the road there was another farmhouse that looked to be abandoned. The windows were covered with plastic sheeting. Beyond the main building was a grove of trees that served to block the view of the nearest neighbour, a clump of buildings almost 600 yards away. So the farm in front of her was relatively isolated. She was close to Lake Anten, in an area of rounded glacial moraines where fields alternated with small communities and dense woodland. The road map gave no detail, but she had followed the black Renault from Göteborg along the E20 and turned west towards Sollebrunn in Alingsås district. After about 40 minutes the car made a sharp turn onto a forest road at a sign that said Gosseberger. She had driven on and parked behind a barn in a clump of trees about 100 yards north of the access road, then returned on foot.
She had never heard of Gosseberger, but as far as she could tell, the name referred to the house and barn in front of her. She had passed the mailbox on the road. Painted on it was P.O. Box 192, K.A. Bodine. The name meant nothing to her. She had made a wide circuit of the buildings and finally selected her lookout spot. She had the afternoon sun at her back. Since she'd gotten into position at around 3:30, only one thing had happened. At 4, the driver of the Renault came out of the house. He exchanged some words in the doorway with someone she could not see. Then he drove away and did not come back. Otherwise, she had seen no movement at the farm. She waited patiently and watched the building through a pair of Minolta 8x binoculars. Blomqvist drummed his fingers in annoyance on the tabletop in the restaurant car. The X-2000 had stopped in Katrineholm and had been standing there for almost an hour. There was some malfunction in one of the carriages that had to be fixed. An announcement apologized for the delay. He sighed in frustration and ordered more coffee. At last, 15 minutes later, the train started up with a jerk. He looked at his watch. 8 p.m. He should have taken a plane, or rented a car. He was now even more troubled by the feeling that he had started too late. At around 6 p.m., someone had turned on a lamp in a room on the ground floor, and shortly after that an oil lamp was lit. Salander glimpsed shadows in what she imagined was the kitchen, to the right of the front door, but she could not make out any faces. Then the front door opened and the giant named Ronald Niedermann came out. He wore dark pants and a tight T-shirt that emphasized his muscles. She had been right. She saw once more that Niedermann really was massive. But he was flesh and blood like everyone else, no matter what Paolo Roberto and Miriam Wu had been through. Niedermann walked around the house and went into the barn where the car was parked. He came out with a small bag and went back inside the house. After only a few minutes, he appeared again. He was accompanied by a short, thin, older man who was using a crutch. It was too dark for Salander to make out his features, but she felt an icy chill creep along the back of her neck. "Daddy, I'm here." She watched Zalachenko and Niedermann as they walked up the road. They stopped at the shed where Niedermann collected some firewood. Then they went back to the house and closed the door. Salander lay still for several minutes. Then she lowered her binoculars and retreated until she was completely concealed among the trees. She opened her backpack, took out a thermos, and poured some coffee. She put a lump of sugar in her mouth and began to suck on it. She ate a cheese sandwich she had bought earlier in the day on the way to Göteborg. As she ate, she thought about the situation. After she had finished, she took out Niemann's Polish P-83 Vanat. She ejected the magazine and checked that nothing was blocking the bolt or the bore. She did a blind fire. She had 6 rounds of 9mm Makarov. That should be enough. She shoved the magazine back in place and chambered around. She put the safety catch on and slipped the weapon into her right-hand jacket pocket. Salander began her advance towards the house, moving in a circle through the woods. She had gone about 150 yards when suddenly she stopped in mid-stride. In the margin of his copy of Arithmetica, Pierre de Fermat had jotted the words, "I have a truly marvellous demonstration of this proposition which this margin is too narrow to contain." The square had been converted to a cube, x cubed plus y cubed equals z cubed, and mathematicians had spent centuries looking for the answer to Fermat's riddle. By the time Andrew Wiles solved the puzzle in the 1990s, he had been at it for 10 years using the world's most advanced computer program. And all of a sudden she understood. The answer was so disarmingly simple. A game with numbers that lined up and then fell into place in a simple formula that was most similar to a rebus. Fermat had no computer, of course. And Weyl's solution was based on mathematics that had not been invented when Fermat formulated his theorem. Fermat would never have been able to produce the proof that Weyl's had presented. Fermat's solution was quite different. She was so stunned that she had to sit down on a tree stump. She gazed straight ahead as she checked the equation. So that's what he meant.
No wonder mathematicians were tearing out their hair.
Then she giggled.
A philosopher would have had a better chance of solving this riddle.
She wished she could have known Fiamma. He was a cocky devil. After a while she stood up and continued her approach through the trees. She kept the barn between her and the house. Chapter 31 Thursday, April 7th. Salander got into the barn through the outside hatch to an old manure drain. There were no livestock. She saw that the barn contained three cars, the white Volvo from Auto Expert, an old Ford, and a somewhat newer Saab. Further in was a rusty harrow and other tools from the days when this had been a working farm. She lingered in the darkness of the barn and watched the house. It was dusk, and the lights were on in all the rooms on the ground floor. She couldn't see any movement, but she thought she saw the flickering glow of a television set. She glanced at her watch. 7:30. Time for rapport. She was surprised that Zalachenko would have chosen to live in such an isolated place. It was not like the man she remembered. She would never have expected to find him out in the country in a little white farmhouse. In some anonymous villa community, maybe, or in a vacation spot abroad. He must have made more enemies even than Salander herself. She was troubled that the place looked so undefended. But she had no doubt that he had weapons in the house. After lingering for a long time, she slipped out of the barn into the twilight. She hurried across the yard, keeping her step light and her back to the facade of the house. Then she heard the faint sound of music. She walked noiselessly around the house and tried to peer through the windows, but they were too high. Salander was instinctively uneasy. For the first half of her life, she had lived in fear of the man inside that house. During the second half, ever since she had failed in her attempt to kill him, she had waited for the moment when he would come back into her life. This time she wasn't going to make any mistakes. Zalachenko might be an old cripple, but he was a trained assassin who had survived on more than one field of battle. Besides, there was Ronald Niedermann to take into account. She would have much preferred to surprise Zalachenko outdoors where he would be unprotected. She had no wish to talk to him, and would have been satisfied with a rifle and a telescopic lens. But she had no rifle, and it was unlikely that he'd be taking an evening stroll. If she wanted to wait for a better opportunity, she would have to withdraw and spend the night in the woods. She had no sleeping bag, and even though the evening was mild, the night would be cold. Now that she had him within reach, she didn't want to risk letting him slip away again. She thought about Miriam Wu and about her mother. She would have to get inside the house, but that was the worst possible scenario. Sure, she could knock on the door and fire her gun as soon as the door opened, and then go in to find the other bastard, but whoever was left would be alerted, and he would probably be armed. Time for a risk assessment. What were the options? She caught sight of Niedermann's profile as he walked past a window only a few yards from her. He was saying something over his shoulder to someone. Both of them were in the room to the left of the front door. She made up her mind. She took the pistol out of her jacket pocket, clicked off the safety, and moved silently onto the porch. She held the gun in her left hand, and she pressed the front door handle down with excruciating caution. It was unlocked. She frowned and hesitated. The door had double deadbolts. Zalachenko should not have left the door unlocked. It was giving her goosebumps on the back of her neck. It felt wrong. The hallway was black as pitch. To the right she glimpsed the stairs to the upper floor. There were two doors straight ahead and one to the left. Light was seeping through a crack above the door. She stood still and listened. Then she heard a voice and the scraping of a chair in the room to the left. She took two swift steps and threw open the door and aimed her gun at... The room was empty. She heard the rustle of clothing behind her and spun around like a lizard. As she tried to raise the gun to firing position, one of Niedermann's enormous hands closed like an iron vice around her neck, and the other clamped around her gun hand. He held her by the neck and lifted her straight up in the air as if she were a doll. For a moment she kicked her feet in midair, then she twisted around and kicked at Niedermann's crotch. She hit his hip instead. It felt like kicking a tree trunk. Her vision was going black as he squeezed her neck, and she felt herself drop the gun.
Fuckers.
Then Niedermann threw her across the room. She landed on a sofa with a crash and slid to the floor. She felt blood rushing to her head and staggered to her feet. She saw a heavy glass ashtray on a table and grabbed it and tried to fling it backhand. Niedermann caught her arm in mid-swing. She reached into her left pants pocket with her free hand and pulled out the taser, twisting around to shove it into Niedermann's crotch. She felt a hefty jolt from the electric shock come through the arm Niedermann was holding her with. She had expected him to collapse in pain. Instead, he looked down at her with a surprised expression. Salander's eyes widened in alarm. He seemed to experience some unpleasantness, but if he felt any pain, he ignored it.
"This man is not normal."
Niedermann bent and took the taser from her and examined it with a puzzled look. Then he slapped her across the head. It was like being hit with a club. She tumbled to the floor next to the sofa. She looked up and saw that Niedermann was watching her curiously, as if wondering what her next move would be, like a cat getting ready to play with its prey. Then she sensed a movement in the doorway. She turned her head. He came slowly into the light. He was leaning on a forearm crutch, and she could see a prosthesis sticking out from his pants leg. There were two fingers missing from his left hand. She raised her eyes to his face. The left half was a patchwork of scar tissue. His ear was a little stump, and he had no eyebrows. He was bald. She remembered him as a virile and athletic man with wavy black hair. Now he was about 5'4" and emaciated.
"Hello, Papa,"
she said tonelessly. Alexander Zalichenko regarded his daughter without expression. Niedermann turned on the ceiling light. He checked that she had no more weapons by running his hands over her clothes and then clicked the safety on the P-83 Vanat and released the magazine. Zalichenko shuffled past them, sat in an armchair, and picked up a remote control. Salander's eyes fell on the TV behind him. Zalichenko pressed the remote, and she saw a green flickering image of the area behind the barn and part of the driveway to the house.
Infrared camera.
They had known she was coming.
"I was beginning to think that you wouldn't dare to make an approach," Zalichenko said. "We've been watching you since 4. You tripped just about every alarm around the farm."
"Motion detectors," Salander said.
"2 by the road, and 4 in the clearing on the other side of the field. You set up your observation post on precisely the spot where we'd positioned alarms. It's the best view of the farm. Usually it's moose or deer, and sometimes berry pickers who come too close. But we don't often get to see somebody sneak up to the front door with a gun in their hand."
He paused for a moment.
"Did you really think Zalichenko would sit in his little house in the country completely unprotected?"
Salander massaged the back of her neck and began to get up.
"Stay there, on the floor," Zalichenko said.
Niedermann stopped fiddling with the gun and watched her quietly. He raised an eyebrow and smiled at her. Salander remembered Paolo Roberto's battered face on TV and decided it would be a good idea to stay on the floor. She breathed out and leaned back against the sofa. Zalichenko held out his intact right hand. Niedermann pulled a weapon out of his waistband, cocked it, and gave it to him. Salander noticed that it was a Sig Sauer, standard police issue. Zalichenko nodded, and Niedermann turned away and put on a jacket. He left the room, and Salander heard the front door open and close.
"In case you get any stupid ideas, if you even try to get up, I'll shoot you right in the gut."
Salander relaxed. He might manage to get off 2, maybe 3 shots before she could reach him, and he was probably using ammo that would make her bleed to death in a few minutes.
"You look like shit," Zarechenko said. "Like a fucking whore. But you've got my eyes."
"Does it hurt?" she asked, nodding at his prosthesis.
Zarechenko looked at her for a long time.
"No. Not anymore."
Salander stared at him.
"You'd really like to kill me, wouldn't you?"
he said. She said nothing. He laughed.
"I've thought about you over the years. In fact, almost every time I look in the mirror."
"You should have left my mother alone."
"Your mother was a whore."
Salander's eyes turned black as coal.
"She was no whore. She worked as a cashier in a supermarket and tried to make ends meet."
Zarechenko laughed again.
"You can have whatever fantasies you want about her, but I know that she was a whore, and she made sure to get pregnant right away, and then tried to get me to marry her. As if I'd marry a whore."
Salander looked down the barrel of the gun and hoped he would relax his concentration for an instant.
"The firebomb was sneaky. I hated you for that. But in time it didn't matter. You weren't worth the energy. If you'd only let things be."
"Bullshit. German asked you to fix me."
"That was another thing entirely. He needed a film that you have, so I made a little business deal."
"And you thought I'd give the film to you?"
"Yes, my dear daughter. I'm convinced that you would have. You have no idea how cooperative people can be when Ronald asks for something, and especially when he starts up a chainsaw and saws off one of your feet. In this case, it would have been appropriate compensation. A foot for a foot."
Salander thought about Miriam at the hands of Niedermann in the warehouse. Zarechenko misinterpreted her expression.
"You don't have to worry. We don't intend to cut you up. But tell me, did Bjurman rape you?"
She said nothing.
"Damn. What appalling taste he must have had. I read in the paper that you're some sort of fucking dyke. That's no surprise. There can't be a man who'd want you."
Salander still said nothing.
"Maybe I should ask Niedermann to screw you. You look as if you need it."
He thought about it.
"Although Ronald doesn't have sex with girls. He's not a fairy. He just doesn't have sex."
"Then maybe you should screw me,"
Salander said to provoke him.
"Come closer. Make a mistake."
"No. Thanks all the same. That would be perverse."
They were silent for a moment.
"What are we waiting for?"
Salander asked.
"My companion is coming right back. He just had to move his car and run a little errand." "Where's your sister?"
Salander shrugged.
"Answer me."
"I don't know, and I honestly don't give a shit."
He laughed again.
"Sisterly love, hey? Camilla was always the one with the brains. You were just worthless filth, but I have to admit it's quite satisfying to see you again up close."
"Zarechenko," she said, "you're a tiresome fuck. Was it Niedermann who shot Bjurman?"
"Naturally. Ronald is the perfect soldier. He not only obeys orders, he also takes his own initiative when necessary."
"Where did you dig him up?"
Zarechenko gave his daughter a peculiar look. He opened his mouth as if to say something, but decided against it. He glanced at the front door and then smiled at Salander.
"You mean you haven't worked it out yet?"
he said.
"According to Bjurman, you're supposed to be a good researcher."
Then Zarechenko roared with laughter.
"We used to hang out together in Spain in the early 90s, when I was convalescing from your little firebomb.
He was 22, and became my arms and legs. He isn't an employee. It's a partnership. We have a flourishing business.
Sex trafficking.
You could say that we've diversified and deal with many different goods and services. Our business model is to stay in the background and never to be seen. But you must have worked out who Ronald is.
Salander did not know what he was getting at.
He's your brother, Zalachenko said.
No, Salander said, breathless. Zalachenko laughed again, but the barrel of the pistol was still pointed unnervingly at her.
"Well, I should say he's your half-brother," Zalachenko said. "The result of a brief diversion during an assignment I had in Germany in 1969.
You've turned your son into a murderer."
"Oh, no. I've only helped him realize his potential. He had the ability to kill long before I took over his training, and he's going to run the family business long after I'm gone."
"Does he know that we're half-siblings?"
"Of course. But if you think you can appeal to his brotherly love, forget it. I'm his family. You're just a buzz on the horizon, and he isn't your only sibling. You have at least 4 more brothers and 3 sisters in various countries. One of your other brothers is an idiot, but another actually has potential. He runs the Tallinn arm of the business. But Ronald is the only one who really lives up to the Zalachenko genes."
"I don't suppose my sisters will get a role in the family business?"
Zalachenko looked startled at the suggestion.
"Zalachenko, you're just an ordinary asshole who hates women. Why did you kill Bjorman?"
"Bjorman was a moron. He couldn't believe it when he learned you were my daughter. He was one of the few people in this country who knew about my background. I have to admit that it made me nervous when he contacted me out of the blue, but then everything turned out for the best. He died, and you got the blame."
"But why shoot him?"
"Well, it wasn't really planned. It's always useful to have a back door into Seppo. Even if I haven't needed one for years, and even if he's a moron. But that journalist in Enschede had somehow found a connection between him and me, and called him just as Ronald was at his apartment. Bjorman panicked, went berserk. Ronald had to make a decision on the spot. He acted quite correctly."
Salander's heart sank like a stone when her father confirmed what she had already suspected. Svensson had found a connection. She had talked to Svensson and Johansson for more than an hour. She liked the woman immediately, but was a little cooler towards the journalist. He reminded her too much of Blomqvist, an insufferable do-gooder who thought he could change everything with a book. But she had recognized his honest intentions. It turned out that her visit had been a waste of time. They couldn't point her to Zalachenko. Svensson had found his name and started digging, but he wasn't able to identify him. Instead, she had made a devastating mistake. She knew that there had to be a connection between Bjorman and Zalachenko, and she asked questions about Bjorman in an attempt to ascertain whether Svensson had come across his name. He hadn't, but his suspicions were instantly aroused. He zeroed right in on Bjorman and plied her with questions. She gave him very little, but he had understood that Salander was a player in the drama. He also realized that he had information she wanted. They had agreed to meet again for further discussions after Easter. Then Salander had gone home to bed. When she woke up the next morning, she was greeted by the news that 2 people had been murdered in an apartment in Enschede. She had given Svensson only 1 piece of usable information, the name Niels Bjorman. He must have called Bjorman the minute she left the apartment. And she was the link. If she hadn't visited Svensson, he and Johansson would still be alive. Zalachenko said,
"You have no idea how surprised we were
when the police started hunting you for the murders.
Salander bit her lip. Zalachenko scrutinized her.
How did you find me?
He said. She shrugged.
Lisbeth, Ronald is coming back soon. I can tell him to break the bonds in your body one by one until you answer. Save us the trouble.
The P.O. box. I traced Niederman's car from the rental agency and waited until that pimply shit showed up and emptied the box.
Aha! So simple. Thanks. I'll remember that.
The muzzle of the pistol was still pointing at her chest.
Do you really think this is going to blow over?
Salander said.
You've made too many mistakes. The police are going to identify you.
I know. Björk called yesterday and told me that a journalist from Millennium has been sniffing around, and that it was just a matter of time. It's possible that we'll have to do something about that.
It'll be a long list, Salander said. Mikael Blomqvist and Erika Berger, the editor-in-chief, the managing editor, and half a dozen others at Millennium alone. And then you have Dragan Armansky and some of his staff at Milton Security, and Detective Inspector Bublansky, and everyone involved in the investigation. How many people would you have to kill to cover this up? No, they're going to get to you.
Zalachenko gave her a horrible, twisted smile.
So what? I haven't shot anybody, and there isn't one shred of forensic evidence against me. They can identify whoever the hell they want. Believe me, they can search this house from top to bottom, and they won't find so much as a speck of dust that could connect me to any criminal activity. It was Seppo who locked you up in the asylum, not me. And it won't take much for them to put all the papers on the table.
Niederman, Lisbeth reminded him.
Early tomorrow morning, Ronald is going on vacation abroad for a while, and he'll wait out whatever develops.
Zalachenko gave Salander a triumphant look.
You're still going to be the prime suspect. So it's best if you just disappear.
It was almost an hour before Niederman returned. He was wearing boots. Salander glanced at the man who, according to her father, was her half-brother. She couldn't see the slightest resemblance. In fact, he was her diametrical opposite. But she felt very strongly that there was something wrong with Niederman. His build, the weak face, and the voice that hadn't really broken, they all seemed like genetic defects of some sort. He had evidently been insensitive to the taser, and his hands were enormous. Nothing about Ronald Niederman seemed quite normal.
There are all sorts of genetic defects in the Zalachenko family, she thought bitterly.
Ready?
Zalachenko asked. Niederman nodded. He held out his hand for the Sieg Sauer.
I'll come with you, Zalachenko said.
Niederman hesitated.
It's quite a walk. I'll come anyway. Get my jacket.
Niederman shrugged and did as he was told. Zalachenko put on his jacket and vanished into the next room for a while. Salander watched as Niederman screwed what appeared to be a homemade silencer onto the gun.
All right. Let's go,
Zalachenko said from the door. Niederman bent and pulled Salander to her feet. She looked him in the eye.
I'm going to kill you, too, she said.
You're very sure of yourself. I'll say that for you, her father said.
Niederman smiled mildly and then pushed her towards the front door and out into the yard. He kept a firm grip on the back of her neck. His fingers could reach almost all the way around it. He steered her towards the woods beyond the barn. They moved slowly and Niederman stopped occasionally to let Zalachenko catch up. They both had powerful flashlights. When they reached the edge of the woods, Niederman let go of Salander's neck. He kept the pistol trained on her back. They followed a difficult path for about 400 yards. Salander stumbled twice, but each time was lifted to her feet.
"Turn right here," Niederman said.
After about 50 feet, they came into a clearing. Lisbeth saw a hole in the ground. In the beam of Niederman's flashlight, she saw a spade stuck in a mound of soil. Then she understood Niedermann's assignment. He pushed her towards the hole, and she tripped and went down on all fours with her hands buried deep in the sandy earth. She got up and gave him an expressionless look. Zalichenko was taking his time, and Niedermann waited patiently. The muzzle of the pistol was unswervingly aimed at her chest. Zalichenko was out of breath. It was more than a minute before he could speak.
"I ought to say something, but I don't think I have anything to say to you," he said.
"That's fine by me," Salander said. "I don't have much to say to you either."
She gave him a lopsided smile.
"Let's get it over with,"
Zalichenko said.
"I'm glad that my very last act was to have you locked away forever," Salander said. "The police will be here tonight."
"Bullshit. I was expecting you to try a bluff. You came here to kill me and nothing else. You didn't say anything to anybody."
Salander's smile broadened. She suddenly looked malevolent.
"May I show you something, Papa?"
Slowly she reached into her left-hand pants pocket and took out a rectangular object. Niedermann watched her every move.
"Every word you've said in the past hour has been broadcast over internet radio."
She held up her palm tungsten T3 computer. Zalichenko's brow furrowed where his eyebrows should have been.
"Let's see that,"
he said, holding out his good hand. Salander lobbed the PDA to him. He caught it in midair.
"Bullshit," Zalichenko said. "This is an ordinary palm."
As Niedermann bent to look at her computer, Salander flung a fistful of sand right into his eyes. He was blinded, but instinctively fired a round from his pistol. Salander had already moved two steps to one side, and the bullet only tore a hole through the air where she had been standing. She grabbed the spade and swung it at his gun hand. She hit him with a sharp edge full force across the knuckles, and saw his Sig Sauer fly in a wide arc away from them and into some bushes. Blood spurted from a gash above his index finger.
"He should be screaming with pain."
Niedermann fumbled with his wounded hand as he desperately tried to rub his eyes with the other. Her only chance to win this fight was to cause him massive damage and as quickly as possible. If it came down to a physical contest, she was hopelessly lost. She needed 5 seconds to make it into the woods. She swung the spade back over her shoulder and tried to twist the handle so that the edge would hit first, but she was in the wrong position. The flat side of the spade smacked into Niedermann's face. Niedermann grunted as his nose broke for the second time in a matter of days. He was still blinded by the sand, but he swung his right arm and managed to shove Salander away from him. She stumbled over a tree root. For a second she was down on the ground, but sprang instantly to her feet. Niedermann was briefly out of action.
"I'm going to make it."
She took 2 steps towards the undergrowth when out of the corner of her eye, click, she saw Zalichenko raise his arm.
"The fucking old man has a gun too."
The realization cracked like a whip through her mind. She changed direction in the same instant the shot was fired. The bullet struck the outside of her hip and made her spin off balance. She felt no pain. The second bullet hit her in the back and stopped against her left shoulder blade. A paralyzing pain sliced through her body. She went down on her knees. For a few seconds, she could not move. She was conscious that Zalichenko was behind her, about 20 feet away. With one last surge of energy, she stubbornly hurled herself to her feet and took a wobbly step towards the cover of the bushes. Zalichenko had time to aim. The third bullet caught her about an inch below the top of her left ear. It penetrated her skull and caused a spider web of radial cracks in her cranium. The lead came to rest in the grey matter about 2 inches beneath the cerebral cortex, by the cerebrum. For Salander, the medical detail was academic. The bullet caused immediate, massive trauma. Her last sensation was a glowing red shock that turned into a white light. Then darkness. Zalichenko tried to fire one more round, but his hands were shaking so hard that he couldn't aim.
"She almost got away."
And then he realized that she was dead, and he lowered his weapon, shivering as the adrenaline flowed through his body. He looked down at his gun. He had considered leaving it behind, but had gone to get it and put it in his jacket pocket as though he needed a mascot.
A monster.
There were two fully grown men, and one of them was Ronald Needham, who had been armed with his Sig Sauer.
And that fucking whore almost got away.
He glanced at his daughter's body. In the beam from his flashlight she looked like a bloody rag doll. He clicked the safety catch on and stuffed the pistol into his jacket pocket and went over to Niedermann, who was standing helpless, tears running from his dirt-filled eyes and blood from his hand and nose.
"I think I broke my nose again," he said.
"Idiot,"
Zalachenko said.
"She almost got away."
Niedermann kept rubbing his eyes. They didn't hurt, but the tears were flowing and he could scarcely see.
"Stand up straight, damn it!"
Zalachenko shook his head in contempt.
"What the hell would you do without me?"
Niedermann blinked in despair. Zalachenko limped over to his daughter's body and grabbed her jacket by the collar. He dragged her to the grave that was only a hole in the ground, too small even for Salander to lie stretched out. He lifted the body so that her feet were over the opening and let her tumble in. She landed face down in a fetal position, her legs bent under her.
"Fill it in so we can go home," Zalachenko commanded.
It took the half-blind Niedermann a while to shovel the soil in around her. What was left over, he spread out around the clearing with powerful jabs of the spade. Zalachenko smoked a cigarette as he watched Niedermann work. He was still shivering, but the adrenaline had begun to subside. He felt a sudden relief that she was gone. He could still picture her eyes as she threw the firebomb all those many years ago. It was 9:30 when Zalachenko shone his flashlight around and declared himself satisfied. It took a while longer to find the Sig Sauer in the undergrowth. Then they went back to the house. Zalachenko was feeling wonderfully gratified. He tended to Niederman's hand. The spade had cut deep, and he had to find a needle and thread to sew up the wound, a skill he had learned in military school in Novosibirsk as a 15-year-old. At least he didn't need to administer an anesthetic. But it was possible that the wound was sufficiently serious for Niederman to have to go to the hospital. He put a splint on the finger and bandaged it. They would decide in the morning. When he was finished, he got himself a beer, as Niedermann rinsed his eyes over and over in the bathroom. Chapter 32. Thursday, April 7th. Blomqvist arrived at Göteborg Central Station just after 9 p.m. The X-2000 had made up some time, but it was still late. He had spent the last hour of the journey calling car rental companies. He'd first thought of finding a car in Alingsås and getting off there, but the office was closed already. Ultimately, he managed to order a Volkswagen through a hotel booking agency in the city. He could pick up the car at Järntorget. He decided not to try to navigate Göteborg's confusing local traffic and incomprehensible ticket system and took a cab to the lot. When he got to the car, there was no map in the glove compartment. He bought one in a gas station, along with a flashlight, a bottle of mineral water and a cup of coffee, which he put in the holder on the dashboard. It was 10:30 before he drove out of the city, on the road to Alingsås. A fox stopped and looked about restlessly. He knew that something was buried there. But from somewhere nearby came the rustle of an unwary night animal, and the fox was instantly on the alert for easier prey. He took a cautious step. But before he continued his hunt, he lifted his hind leg and pissed on the spot to mark his territory. Boblansky did not normally call his colleagues late in the evening, but this time he couldn't resist. He picked up the phone and dialed Murdig's number.
"Pardon me for calling so late. Are you up?"
"No problem."
"I've just finished going through Björk's report."
"I'm sure you had as much trouble putting it down as I did."
"Sonia, how do you make sense of what's going on?"
"It seems to me that Gunnar Björk, a prominent name on the list of Johns, if you remember, had Lisbeth Salander put in an asylum after she tried to protect herself and her mother from a lunatic sadist who was working for Seppo. He was abetted in this by Dr. Teleborian, among others, on whose testimony we in part based our own evaluation of her mental state."
"This changes the entire picture we have of her."
"It explains a great deal.
Sonya, could you pick me up in the morning at 8?
Of course.
We're going to go down to Smodellerow to have a talk with Gunnar Bjerk. I made some inquiries. He's on sick leave.
I'm looking forward to it already.